Coming up Saturday at 2 on Hometown Heroes, two Central Coast veterans remember their service in World War II. For one Morro Bay Marine, his Purple Heart, a reminder of how fortunate he was to make it home.
It was by the grace of God I ever survived that. I think the guy jerked the trigger. Or that split my head like a watermelon.
On this Independence Day weekend, ponder the price of freedom on Hometown Heroes. Saturday afternoon at 2 on News Talk 920 KVEC.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. Never seeking any attention for it, but just quietly going on with their lives. Maybe they're down the street, around the corner, or just right next door. But I'm yet to find an exception to that rule. Whether it's Missoula, Montana, or Rochester, New York, Dripping Springs, Texas, or Laguna, New Mexico, wherever I go, there are veterans with remarkable stories to tell all over these United States. And we want to honor those veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made on our behalf. We want to preserve their stories so they don't get lost under the sands of time. And along the way, we learn something new with each visit. We're educated, entertained, and at times even inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. It'll be a little different this week. We're actually going to hear from two World War II veterans, both living on California's beautiful Central Coast. News Talk 920 KVEC has been airing Hometown Heroes there for over a year, and I had a chance to visit the KVEC studios and interview these two gentlemen in a bit of a simulcast. The interviews are also going to air on the TV program High Profile, which you can catch all through the month of July on Charter Cable Channel 2 there in the San Luis Obispo area. As a result of this simulcast, the recording might sound a little different than it usually does, and I do want to throw out this caveat for you. You know, sometimes terms that were very commonplace in referring to the enemy 70 years ago, whether you're in Europe or the Pacific, they might pop up a time or two in some of these interviews, and I know they will today. These men are not trying to be insensitive or insulting. They're just reliving what they went through all those years ago. And I, of course, want to be sensitive to anyone who might take offense, but also be true to the experiences of these veterans. So I just wanted to warn you, hope when you hear something like that, you'll take it in context. These two men met each other for the first time the day we got together. One, a Navy corpsman pressed into gun crew duty on an LSM. The other, a Marine wounded on Okinawa. Believe it or not, they were born 5 days apart in February of 1924, both from Southern California. And it was really neat to see the bond that they formed in such a short period of time, born, of course, out of their similar experiences. It reminded me of what we continue to see with Honor Flight, the program flying World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. And for the Central Coast of California, where today's program was recorded, the next flight will take off from San Luis Obispo September 30th. You can go to honorflight.org to locate a hub in your area, and let's try to get as many of our World War II vets there as we can before it's too late. First up on this Hometown Heroes simulcast is Ivan Hudson, a graduate of the now defunct Excelsior Union High School in Norwalk, California, whose other alumni include the actor William Conrad and former First Lady Pat Nixon. But your hometown wasn't Norwalk, it was Bellflower. And what was life like in Bellflower before World War II?
Very quiet. They grew a lot of vegetables and fruit trees all over town. Mm-hmm. You could grow anything in Bellflower, yeah.
But you and your brother never got in any trouble or anything, did you?
No, I don't recollect any. A little bit, maybe, but I don't recollect it too much.
The year you graduated was 1942, tells me during your senior year the world changed a little bit. Do you remember December 7th, 1941?
Yeah, sure do, yeah.
How did you find out the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor?
Over the radio at home, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we heard it over the radio. That's really all we knew.
Was that a big deal to you? Did it rock your world a little bit? Did you grasp it?
No, I didn't. No, it didn't get a hold of me. It was momentous, but it didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. You know. Well, it would grab you when Uncle Sam sent you a letter, right?
That's when it grabbed me.
And you had some advice about what to do if Uncle Sam called you?
Yeah, the old timers that I run into says, don't let the Army get you. I had 2 weeks, so I went down and got Mom and joined the Navy.
What were your expectations about the Navy? Was this going to be an adventure, go see the world?
Right, right. That was it. Dry bed and 3 squares a day in the Navy. And in the Army, it was mud, you know, mud, and you never knew what you were going to get. That's why I didn't let the Army get me. I was going to be a gunner's mate, and they grabbed me and says, no, you're going to be a corpsman. And that's the way it ended up. So I had to go to school and to Farragut, Idaho. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, things happened pretty fast.
Well, I've talked to a lot of Navy veterans who had training in Farragut, Idaho.
Right.
And, of course, you're from Southern California. You're thinking, the Navy, I'm going to be out in the Pacific. It's going to be nice and warm. Then they send you to snowy Idaho in the dead of winter, right?
Yeah, right, dead of winter's right. Eleanor Roosevelt, that was her idea.
Did that break you in a little bit?
Yeah.
Toughen you up?
Yeah, it sure did. Got sick. Scarlet fever, the measles. Ooh.
So you knew what it was like to be a patient, but before long you'd be helping patients at Oak Knoll Naval Hospital out in Oakland, California. And I want to ask you about some of the men you helped nurse back to health, but let's start with your supervisor, because I understand you have some very vivid memories of a particular nurse you had to work under.
Mama Gladden. Uh-huh. Yeah, very nice. But she had it in for me, and
why'd she have it in for you?
I have no idea. I never could figure it out, because I was a nice guy. I behaved myself all the time.
But you were a baby-faced redhead, and you're a big target?
Maybe that was it. I never could figure it out why she picked on me, but she did.
What did she do? How did she pick on you?
She put me on night duty, and any crummy job on the ward come up, she'd get Ivan. Ivan would do it. Put me in the detail. I got the kitchen detail, where I had to clean up all the trays. It was always mop the floors, and nobody else was doing it but me. I'm the guy that got stuck with it.
But during your time there, the wars started. There's already some fighting in the Pacific, and you actually had to deal with some of the casualties from the Marines in the Pacific?
Guadalcanal. That's who was on the ward. It was all Guadalcanal guys, with the exception of a very few.
What kind of injuries did you see? I'm sure that made an impression on you, the state these guys are in.
It was all bedfast, and they had bed sores because they couldn't move, just lay in that bed. And bed sores was a big thing. Treating those bed sores, it was pretty bad. Poor guys, they just lay there and suffer with various injuries, you know, wounds and whatnot.
Was that hard to see and to know that, you know, you might be heading overseas at some point, some of the same areas these guys are coming from?
Yeah, I thought a lot about it, yeah. And everybody else did think about it, too. Every day they would go out and look at the list. And it was the dreaded list. And if your name was on that list, that meant you was going into the Marine Corps as a corpsman, and that they were scared to death to be sitting in the Marine Corps as a corpsman, because you're running around following the Marines, and the percentage of getting shot was pretty high. You just had to get out there and take care of the Marines that were being shot at. Anyway, this buddy of mine, one day he walked out there and he saw his name on the list, gonna go. And he broke down and just cried like a baby. It really upset him. And I felt so bad for him. My name never showed up for that job. But his did, and I never saw him again. He just disappeared, so I don't know what ever happened. I guess they grabbed him and shipped him out.
You're not complaining that your name never showed up on that list?
That's right. I was very fortunate. That's the way I look at it. I was fortunate it didn't show up on the list.
Yeah, you never had to follow Marines into combat, but you would head overseas as a pharmacist mate on LSM 107. That's a transport ship. LSM, of course, stands for Landing Ship Medium. You guys were hauling oil, gas, troops, vehicles. And I understand you got a really encouraging speech from the captain of your ship.
Yeah, he said, the equipment on this ship is not expendable, meaning the guns and the ammo. But he says, you are, he says. You men are expendable. And we just looked at each other because we didn't get it. You know, what are you going to do? You're expendable. Everybody felt real good about that.
I'm sure, yeah. And of course, that was they made a movie with that title with John Wayne and PT boats about them being expendable. How did that make you feel when it did sink in and you realized what he was really saying?
Like nothing. Yeah, we just looked at each other. We felt bad anyway, you know, going out, heading out, and it just made us feel worse, put it that way. He was, the skipper was, he never came out of that wardroom. No matter where we were at, He never came out.
Huh.
Except to make a speech like that, and he'd go back in the wardroom, and that was it.
Well, and pretty soon you would find out, I guess, what it was he meant. Every veteran can remember that moment where the war became real for him. This isn't a game or an idea anymore. This is life or death. Do you remember a moment like that?
Yeah, the Philippines. Yeah. We had to cruise along there. The Japs were hiding in the forest there. Luzon, that's it. You've heard of Luzon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Luzon. And our job was to, we only drew 4 feet of water. I was in the amphibs. And it was shallow, and we could get pretty close. So the Army went over and dropped the flares over the jungle there and trying to force the Japs to run out on the beach so we could get them. And, and it never happened. No Japs. They didn't show up. They were stuck in that forest, and they didn't come out.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was assigned to a 50 caliber machine gun. I was the, we had the gunner, and then I was a loader.
Uh-huh.
You know, feed the belt in with the shells, you know.
Right.
That was my job. One time there, we pulled in, we hit the beach there, and we always had to drop the anchor in the back and hit the beach. But the guy in the back, the Japs threw shot a mortar over the jungle and blew the guy in the fantail, he on a 50 caliber, they blew him off, and we was in a hell of a mess there, trying to get off the beach. Because the anchor was dropped back there and we had to pull back, see?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had a hell of a time, but we made it.
And I want to dive a little deeper on that. So basically, you're saying this was a pretty close call, and that could have been the end of it for you that day. I mean,
right.
There's enemy artillery coming. How close to you?
I don't know. One side, of, you know, then the other side, and they miss.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God they hit the back of the fantail, though, and just knocked the end of it off. But the guy in the back, that's all we got hit, where we were lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I figured they had us lined up, and the next one would hit us.
Yeah.
But they did, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
They missed us, just that one. I figured that was it, because we couldn't get off the beach, see? Had a hell of a time getting off, but we did.
Did you hear much from your family when you were overseas?
When I write Mom a letter, I tried to put something under the stamp, you know, and put the stamp on top of it, a little message about where we were at.
Yeah.
Everything was taboo, no. Well, everything was censored.
And I've heard some of those stories.
Yeah.
They'd actually take out the razor blade and cut out different words if you tried to reveal anything about your location, but...
Yeah.
The
You're
stuff
right.
that you wrote under the stamp, did you actually get those through to your...
Yeah, they got through.
All right.
Yeah.
Clever.
Yeah.
Did someone tell you that, or you figured that out on your own?
I forget, really, but anyway, I guess I figured it out. Somebody else might have done it, though.
What impression did you have of the men that you served with? What kind of guys were they?
Oh, by and large, pretty good. There's always a few jerks around, you know, like the boatswain's mate, he was mean. You know, got the guy come up there and sick one time, and... I said, go ahead and get in your sack. So he went and got in bed. And the boats slipped down there in the crew's quarters and told him to get back to work. So me and the boat had a little tussle there about that.
Mm-hmm.
I had to straighten him out,
mm-hmm.
which I did.
No one ever had to straighten you out?
No. No, they tried to a couple times, but well, I had my rights, see. I had 24 on and 24 off because I was the pharmacist's mate on independent duty.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason I got out of it. I didn't have to stand any watches because mm-hmm. I was on call constantly. Fortunately, I didn't have to repair anybody. I just had to set a broken arm, and one guy got in a fight down in the crew's quarters and busted his lip, and I had to sew him up, and little things like that. But I never had anything big to do.
Yeah.
No, nothing serious, put it that way.
And I'm sure over the years you've come to understand that a lot of people did have some real serious things to do in those parts of the world.
Oh, they did. Oh, yeah.
What was the maybe most jarring thing that you saw or witnessed, the thing that kind of still sticks with you today?
I guess that one incident. The others, everything else was just waiting for something to happen, kind of. Like on Okinawa, we had a smoke machine attached to the back of the ship, and our job was to twine around in between the big ships and lay that smoke. So when the kamikazes come in, you know, they couldn't see them.
Right.
That was a big thing right at that time, those kamikazes.
And you witnessed some kamikazes.
Yeah, witnessed come pretty bad there. Yeah.
Can you tell us about that, what you saw?
Come in there, you know, do about 400 miles an hour in those zeros, just skimming over that water like that. And they didn't bother us because we had a small ship, but sitting right over there was an LST, you know, which was... 3 times bigger than a landing ship tank, big. this chap went right by. We tried to lead him with the 50s, but it's hard to do when the guy's going sideways. You know, you're trying to, you got to lead him. You miss him. And he hit that LST, and that was a big mess. It didn't sink, though, but it was, you know, there we were watching it right off.
And you were still on those guns at that time? You were part of those gun crews?
Yeah, part of the gun, yeah.
I know it was a long time ago, but I'm sure you remember what that felt like. Did you ever feel scared? Did you ever feel like, you know what, this might be it for me?
Well, the only thing we were scared about, if it was going to hit us. We had to figure it out later that we were small, and that's why they didn't bother us. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to waste a pilot in a plane on a little ship like us, put 65 people on. That was our crew, 65 mm-hmm. people. And that's what we figured out. They wanted the big one, so an LST was pretty good size, so they hit that. And transports around there, and cruisers, destroyers.
I'm imagining most of the people watching this and listening to this didn't experience anything like what you went through or have seen anything like this. Can you help us understand how severe some of these situations were? I'm sure on some of these areas you probably saw some of the after effects and the devastation.
Well, yeah, this one young fellow, we were all young, of course, 19 or 20. This one guy, his hair turned white right after one of the scares like that, one of the little battles, you know. Yeah, his hair turned white just overnight, just like that.
He had dark hair.
Right. He had dark hair and it turned white. It was amazing. Never saw anything like that. Nerves. All nerves. We never knew anything out there in that ship because the skipper didn't communicate with us at all. We didn't know the war was over until 15 days later.
Really?
Yeah.
Where were you?
Okinawa, waiting for we were going to hit the mainland of Jap in November. Because I remember when the guy ran out of the conning tower there and he says, the war's over. And he went back in, come back out. Nope, it's not over. Went back in, came out again, said, yeah, it's over.
If you were preparing for the invasion of Japan, yeah. I suppose those atomic bombs maybe saved your life?
Oh, they did. Truman, Harry Truman. There was the guy. There was the angel, Harry Truman. He told him to drop it, and otherwise we'd have hit the beach, and they figured about a million guys maybe would have. We'd have been the first or second wave, and we'd have bought it sometime in there.
So your LSM would have been landing troops
right.
and vehicles
right.
on mainland Japan?
Yeah, troops and oil and gas. Mm-hmm. We never knew sometimes what we were going to haul. We just hauled everything, really.
Were you ever really concerned that you wouldn't come home? Was that ever a question in your mind?
Yeah, day and night. It covers you like a blanket. You just, one day at a time, you get up, you know, you're alive. What's going to happen today? Jap going to get you or what? You never knew. Always sit thinking, though. You're thinking all the time. What's going to happen next?
So I guess you were pretty thankful to come home.
Yeah, I really was. It was amazing, I thought, that we made it.
Never had to deal with a typhoon or any wild weather or anything?
Oh, yeah. Forgot about that. We got caught in that typhoon in 45. It was a big one. Yeah. Took out a lot of the little ships. It busted our fantail, and we got a big leak in the fantail, so they had to seal it off, tighten the dogs, you know, at the back.
Yeah.
And we went in when we got to the States, we were like this, a dragon, but we made it. That was really bad.
What did that feel like on your ship? Because I don't think most of us have ever been on an LSM in the middle of a typhoon.
You go from the bottom, and it just takes you right up about 50 feet up in the air, then drops you right back down the bottom again. And this is the way it went. And you wonder each time if you're going to get back up again, that you just hang on and wait.
And what are you hanging on to? Where are you on the ship?
Yeah, I was in the sick bay and just plastered to the wall, you know, holding on. Then I'd get outside and get up on the deck, and I had plenty of support up there on the lines, you know, and just watch the waves. Beautiful sight.
Beautiful sight.
Yeah, beautiful sight. Way up there, and you drop you right down like that again to the bottom. Pretty jarring, though. It was real jarring.
Yeah, I think I'd be scared out of my wits in a moment like that.
Yeah, we were. Yeah.
And then when your fantail cracks, that would shake things up a little bit more.
Yeah, that shook everything up real good.
Were you thinking you guys might have to abandon ship?
Yeah, we were, but we didn't. We only went down so far in the fantail. It started dragging, but it stopped.
Mm-hmm.
So there was water in the fantail, but they had it sealed off. So there we were. And we made it. It took us 2 months to get back to the States, so 10 miles an hour.
What was the best part about coming home for you?
The realization that the war was over and that you was going to go on with your life, mm-hmm. whatever it might be.
When you think back on it now, you look at those pictures of this baby-faced sailor. What are you most thankful for? What are you most proud of?
That I made it, that I got through the whole thing. I guess that would be it, yeah. Good experience.
Yeah?
Yeah, good experience.
That is 90-year-old Navy veteran Ivan Hudson. And up next, we're going to meet his newfound friend, John Wilcox, who fought with the 1st Marine Division in the often overlooked but very bloody battle for Peleliu and was later wounded while serving on Okinawa. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different twist today, hearing from two veterans living on California's Central Coast. The interviews you're hearing on the radio today were also recorded for television and will be airing throughout the month of July in the San Luis Obispo area on Charter Cable Channel 2. That's thanks to David Ryle, John Kurt, and their program, High Profile. Thanks to Andrew Cannon and the staff of our Hometown Heroes affiliate, KVEC, for allowing us to use their studio to record today's show. Time now to meet 90-year-old John Wilcox. He's enjoying the Central California coastline now in the shadow of Morro Rock, but it was some very different coastline he encountered 70 years ago with the 1st Marine Division on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. And before that, he grew up in the Los Angeles area, two brothers, two sisters. You were right in the middle. What do you remember about growing up in L.A.?
You know, the most fun we had was going out in the orange orchard and shooting rabbits with a 20-gauge double barrel.
And what do you think stands on the area where you did that now?
They're certainly not shooting there, that's for sure.
If they are, they're not shooting rabbits. Times
probably
have changed.
Aren't any orange trees.
Yeah, no orange trees for sure. Do you remember how you found out that America had been attacked in December of 41?
Yeah, it was on the radio.
It seems like every veteran has a memory of that day. Everyone who was alive then remembers that. What did that mean to you to hear that the Japanese had attacked the U.S.?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot we could do about it at that time. It was kind of a shame to lose all those sailors. I think we lost 2,800 or something.
And you read about that, maybe saw some newsreels, started to grasp how devastating the damage there was?
Yeah, everything was on the radio.
When did you decide that you wanted to be one of the few, the proud, the Marines?
Well, when Uncle Sam told me they needed me pronto.
Your brother was already in?
Yeah, he was older. He's 4 years older than I was.
And he was a paratrooper, right?
Yeah. He just died a year ago.
So
we're pretty lucky. All three of us got through the thing.
You had a younger brother that served at the end of the war as well?
Yeah.
For you, the Marine Corps. Why the Marine Corps?
Well, because they had a certain job to do, and the Navy had so many different jobs that they could put you in that I didn't want any part of that, and nobody wanted to go into the Army, so the Marine Corps was about all that was left.
It's funny, I've heard a lot of different stories from guys on why they joined the Marine Corps, but I don't know that I'd heard the process of elimination quite like that, as you described it. What was the hardest part of your training in the Marines?
Crawling under the barbed wire with a 30 caliber machine gun shooting over your head. All the guy had to do was move the gun and you'd have been dead.
A lot of people don't realize that this was going on all over the place in World War II, training with live ammunition. So you've got to keep your head down, and that guy on the gun better be accurate, or you're going to have some casualties right there in training.
I never met him, but he missed me.
What did that do for you? Did that help you maybe learn that this is real?
Yeah, it let me know that the Marine Corps was kind of serious.
Little margin for error, huh?
No error.
Do you remember what it felt like to head overseas, say goodbye to your family?
We left San Diego. Took us 18 days to get to New Caledonia, which is a French province. I was seasick before I got out of the harbor, and I was seasick still when I got to New Caledonia 18 days later.
Had you ever been on a ship before?
No.
No wonder you were seasick. That doesn't sound very encouraging. Here you're starting off this adventure, but you know it's your life's going to be at risk, and you're seasick the whole journey, huh?
Yeah.
Were you thinking, hey, there's no place like home, get me out of here?
No. Well, you don't get out.
That's right.
Unless you're dead.
A lot of people have heard about some of the Pacific battles. They've certainly heard about Iwo Jima, and they've seen those iconic images, and maybe they've heard about Okinawa, where you would end up wounded, but a lot of people have not heard about Peleliu, and it's a shame because there are a lot of American lives lost there. I believe close to 2,000 Americans killed and another 8,000 wounded just on this island in a battle that was supposed to last, I think in one of the Admiral's estimates, 4 days? But you guys were there for what, 2.5 months?
No, I never kept track of how long we were there.
What do you remember about getting there?
Well, I remember coming off of the landing ship. I was carrying a BAR at the time. Oh, I saw our Marines ahead of me. There was a little fat schoolboy major there in the Marines, and he was jumping up and down trying to get the Marines off the beach up into the higher land. It had a raised, the water was much lower than the turf that you had to get on to go mm-hmm. on. And we could see the tracer bullets going over, so there was a Jap machine gun nest up there. And they quit firing after a while, but all these Marines were on the beach, and this poor young major, he was trying to get them up over the level ground.
Yeah.
But there was still these tracer bullets going by, and nobody was anxious to stick their head up and get it shot off.
Did you have any idea what you were in for there?
Well, I knew that we either sink or swim. We either survived or we didn't.
And you mentioned carrying a BAR, Browning Automatic Rifle, so you had a little more firepower than some of the Marines with you might have had.
That thing was invented and used in World War I, which was 20 years earlier.
You're saying it didn't always work the way it was supposed to?
Oh, it was reliable, but they had a spring in there that could get weak, and the spring threw the bolt forward in the gun, and it never happened to me, but I'd heard it happen to some Marines that had used the BAR. It was a pretty good weapon you could put out a lot of firepower with it. It had 20-round clips. You could fire it fully automatic, which wasn't like weapons today, but it was still pretty awesome.
The one spot on that island that has become infamous because it was so difficult for American forces to capture was Bloody Nose Ridge. Did you have any experience there?
Yeah, when we landed, the Marines had a couple of 105s that they didn't get into operation, and we didn't have any of our tanks get on shore. So MacArthur sent a couple of his Army tanks over to us with their crews in them. When a tank went into battle, they always sent a group with them. That's infantrymen that could fend off any enemy infantry from throwing charges on the tank or anything. We'd shoot them if they tried. I think where we were with those Army tanks, two of them, was Bloody Nose Ridge. Three other guys with me were on one tank, and I don't know who was taking care of the other tank, but they threw canister at us, but we were in pretty good shape because we had the tank between us and the gunners, the Jap gunners. And they fired these canisters, which are ball bearings that I don't know how many were in there. I guess there's 100 and some in a shell. We were protected by the tank itself because we were behind it or to the side of it. I was laying there and the damn tank backed up and damn near pinned me. With its tracks, I had my arm right where the track came back.
Holy moly.
They were backing up, so I moved.
I guess so. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of times you had to move, and I know you would eventually be wounded on Okinawa, but did you have some close calls at Peleliu?
That was pretty close.
The tank?
Defending our tank against the Jap.
I
was able to point out where the Jap fire was coming from because when they fired the gun, they had yellow smoke that came up. We didn't have yellow smoke in our ammunition, so mm-hmm. there'd be a jet shooting out. That's when they shot the canister. And then they tried to put a projectile down the barrel of the gun on the tank. They had that tank had either a 75 or 76 millimeter gun on it, and they didn't make it. It skinned the barrel of the tank. I got a piece of the brass off of something in my leg, but it was just a scratch.
That sounds close enough for me.
Yeah.
So you're on a tank, and they hit the barrel and splinter it, and a piece of it goes into your leg.
No, they hit the side of the barrel. They uh-huh. didn't get it. If they'd have gotten it in the barrel, it would have probably exploded the shell that was in the gun.
Yeah.
In the tank, and that would have been that one tank that would be out of action.
And you might not be talking to me.
Well, that's possible. But I'm talking.
And I'm glad you are. Did you see buddies that were wounded, that were killed? Can you help us understand what that scene was like? Because that helps us understand that the price that was paid for us.
The one thing that was really strange about it, they had a 10-inch naval gun up at the end of the airport. They'd fire that thing, it sounded like a train going by. But they'd only fire it once in a while, and I think they fired it for about 5 days, maybe once or twice a day at most, and then no more. So they either ran out of ammunition, or that's all it could have been. They ran out of stuff to fire. I think the gun got so hot when they fired it that they could only fire it once in a while.
I mean, you're 19, 20 years old while this kind of stuff is going on. Were you scared?
Well, there's no reason to be scared. You're either alive or dead. I mean, what the heck?
Where did that come from? Because I think a lot of people would be shaking in their boots. How do you think you maintained your composure and your focus and survived all of that?
We just had a job to do and we did it.
Did you leave some buddies behind on that island? Did you lose anyone that you knew?
Well, I never got that buddy with any of them. I mean, I didn't get that friendly with any of them.
Was that by design?
Well, it's kind of by, you just don't get friendly with the troops. That way you don't miss them when they're gone, for one thing. And it's a real effort to stay alive when you're in a situation like that.
Let me read you something here, because this was in Huntington Beach Press Telegram and Long Beach Sun back in January of 45, and it's talking about you. You guys had turkey dinner for Christmas in the Philippines or in the Pacific somewhere, but it goes on to talk about Peleliu. They wrote you up in September of 44. That battle started in September, went all the way to November, and it said, when his fire team leader became a casualty while attacking a well-fortified enemy position, Private First Class Wilcox unhesitatingly took over the team and directed their fire to such advantage that the objective was secured with no additional casualties. They called it heroic leadership, and your indomitable fighting spirit were in keeping with the highest traditions of the U.S. Naval Service. Was this the incident when you saw the yellow smoke?
No, that was...
Tell me about this that the article's about. Who got wounded? It says your fire team leader became a casualty.
Well, I don't even know who he was. We just passed the word from man to man as things progress. And
what made you step forward and lead?
Well, I guess because I was a squad leader.
Because, you know, they don't write that kind of stuff about a guy that didn't do anything or a guy that didn't step up. When you received that citation, did it mean anything to you?
Well, yeah, I wasn't impressed, no.
You were just happy to be alive?
Yeah.
Let's talk about Okinawa.
Well, we're in the First Marines were in reserve. I think there were something like 6 Army divisions on Okinawa when we got off our boat that we were on, went down a cargo netting with all our equipment and got into a little LCVP or whatever they call them, those little mm-hmm. boats with a ramp on the front. And we were the 13th wave. We were ready reserved to replace any Army division that got clobbered. None of them did, so we didn't do much.
You didn't do much, but I believe you have a Purple Heart from that island.
Yeah, it was by the grace of God I ever survived that.
Tell me about it. What happened?
There was a big crevice, and we'd taken that hill that day. We were ordered to take the hill, and we got the high ground. I didn't lose a man, but when we were in the trenches there at the top of the hill, management was throwing smoke in the area where we advanced through the mortar barrage. They didn't give us face masks or anything, so all the smoke made us cough, and one Jap heard one of us coughing and tossed a grenade over the bank, and it landed next to a Marine from the 7th Marines. He came to us and said, "I'm your contact." The grenade fell under him, I guess, and or he was on top of it when it went off, so that ended him.
Did he smother that to save other lives?
No,
it just happened to be under him.
We were all coughing. Nobody could stand the smell of smoke without coughing. And all they had to do was issue us face masks, and they wouldn't have been coughing, and the guy wouldn't have been located to get a grenade tucked under his body.
There are a lot of those kind of what-ifs, I'm sure, throughout your story. That's one guy in your crew that's out, but you almost got taken out, too. You got a bullet in your shoulder, didn't you?
Yeah, through my ear. I think the guy jerked the trigger, or that split my head like a watermelon. He was behind me, and he was a sniper.
Tell me where
As
that
I
was.
As I say, that was right next to Shirry Castle. They were going to defend that property regardless what happened.
Yes, Shirry Castle, at least 500 years old at that point, and the historic home of Okinawan royalty. It would be almost completely destroyed by the Marines in 1945, but it was later rebuilt, eventually reopened a little more than 20 years ago. You can visit it today. But John Wilcox never reached it, hit by sniper fire as he approached. We'll explore more about that in a moment and find out how he made it out of there alive when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. A different twist today with a combined radio and TV interview of two veterans from California's Central Coast. We heard first from Ivan Hudson, a Navy corpsman, and we've been listening to 90-year-old John Wilcox remember his Marine Corps experiences. When we left off, he'd been approaching Shirry Castle, legendary palace of the Ryukyu Kingdom on Okinawa. The castle would be nearly destroyed by the end of that battle, but Mr. Wilcox never got to see it firsthand, because he was shot from behind by a sniper's bullet. Walk us through, if you can, how that happened and how it was that you survived.
I must have been bent over a little bit because the bullet entered my back and came out my shoulder, went through my ear, and I guess it took my helmet with it. But fortunately, there was a guy there that I don't know what his job was, but he saved my life by putting a... They had packs that you could...
Had a compress?
Yeah. He put it on me, and then he had a radio, and he called for a vehicle, and we got a Jeep up there with a stretcher.
So if he wasn't there to stop the bleeding...
Yeah, if he hadn't put the pack on me, why, I'd have bled to death right there.
I know this is a long time ago, and I know it's really not easy to talk about, but I'm just picturing you. You're bending over, you get shot in the back, goes through your ear, takes your helmet off. What were you thinking? What was that like for you?
I was thinking the guy jerked a trigger. Squeeze it, he jerked it, pulled the rifle out of line so the projectile just hit on me on the side.
And are there some moments there where you don't know how bad it is and you're trying to figure out what just happened?
No. First thing I knew, the guy was on top of me with a K-bar cutting my jacket off.
So if he hadn't been there?
That'd have been history.
And I think your daughter brought you here today. She would have never been born. Probably a few other people wouldn't be born. And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but how do you account for that? The fact that things happened just the way they did.
Must have been pretty lucky.
Well, it took a lot of courage for you to be there in the first place, and I realize it takes courage to
talk about it. Just took notice from the government. We need you.
Well, that's all the more impressive that you have that humble attitude about it. What did that mean for you from there? Were you off the lines for a little while?
It wasn't long. When you recuperate, they put you back into the swing of things. They transported me from where I was at Shirry Castle down to the hospital that was near an airport there. Mm-hmm. And I woke up the next morning, and I'd had a shot of morphine when I got hit. First thing they do, they give you a shot of morphine to deaden the pain.
But you felt some pain before that.
No, I didn't feel. I thought Joe DiMaggio had laid a bat across my shoulder. That's what it felt like. Mm. A Louisville slugger, in fact.
How did you deal with that?
No problem. Got better.
No problem.
Well, I just broke my collarbone playing football in high school before I went to the Marines. That was more painful than anything.
Have you had any lingering effects of that injury in all the years since?
No, even that broken collarbone quit aching. It took about 50 years.
Do you ever wear your Purple Heart?
I don't even know where it is.
Well, I get the sense you probably haven't talked a whole lot about World War II over the years.
No.
Why not?
Well, there were 13 million men in the service, and I just never was really buddies with any of them. My squad had a 17-year-old terror in it, a red-headed kid from Fresno. I don't know, he picked me for a squad leader, I don't know why. And another squad leader I remember was a New York cop named Miller. And we had a boxing match one time. He hit me 6 times, I hit him 3 times, and he put the threw the gloves down.
That was enough.
Yeah. I hit him with haymakers, and he hit me with the punch and jab.
You were one of those pound-for-pound guys, huh?
Well, little guys.
Yeah. Are you proud of what you did in the war?
Well, I like being alive.
Do you think people today understand what you did and what all those other millions of Americans did?
I don't think anybody could put themselves in our positions. I mean, every decision you make, it's either life or death to you or some enemy.
Were there some other moments for you that was really crystal clear? I mean, the couple of the ones you've shared with us, it sounds pretty clear that that could have ended it for you. Were there others where you look back on now and say, wow, I was really fortunate, or someone was really looking out for me?
Well, you get pretty close to the maker when you're out there.
And I've heard that from a lot of guys. And, you know, the old, there's no atheists in foxholes comes to mind, or guys, some guys have said, you know, I wasn't just saying that, it was really real for me, and they've shared, you know, in moments they actually would utter a prayer. When you say you got close to the maker out there, how did that unfold for you? What was that really like for you?
Oh, he had to be on my side for me to survive what I did. It's nice to have a buddy.
What are you most thankful for when you look back on all of it?
The war ended. We won.
Have you been to the World War II Memorial in Washington?
No. My war was in the Pacific. I have no reason to go to Washington. Besides that, you're not too welcome there anyhow.
Well, at that place you are, and there are a lot of folks trying to get veterans to that memorial, but the reason I ask is I think the spot at that World War II Memorial that seems to mean the most to veterans who see it is a wall of gold stars, and it's a star for every 100 who was killed, so it signifies 405,000 Americans who died in World War II. Do you ever think about that? Think about that price that was paid?
Lucky to be here. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else that you think your kids and grandkids and the rest of us need to know about what happened then and why you guys did what you did?
No, we just did what we had to do.
So that's John Wilcox, 90 years old, of Morro Bay, California. That simulcast, if you will, with the high-profile television show. If you're in the San Luis Obispo area on the central coast of California, you can catch it. Charter Cable Channel 2 all through the month of July. It'll air on Saturdays at 11 a.m., Sundays at 1 p.m., or Tuesdays at 9 p.m. So check that out if you're in the area, and it'll give you a chance to see what these veterans look like and see some of the emotion in their eyes that I'm sure you recognized in their voices as well. If you don't live on the Central Coast, you can still see what John and Ivan look like. I've got a few photos posted on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and, of course, at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done quite yet. Once the cameras stopped rolling, I had a few more questions for Mr. Wilcox, and our Hometown Heroes affiliate, KVEC, was gracious enough to let us stick around and explore his Marine Corps experience a little further. So we're going back to when you were hit. You get evacuated to an ambulance, but you're the first one on the ambulance?
On the Jeep. They sent a Jeep up there. I guess the guy that was with me, I didn't know whether he was an officer or what he was. I thought he might have been a preacher or something, but he didn't have a weapon. And we were both in that area. I just happened to get shot, and he didn't. But he's the one that cut my jacket off with his K-bar knife and called for an ambulance. And we got two ambulances. We got the Jeep, and then we had a track vehicle also come up there that would hold about a dozen more stretchers. And I was afraid I was going to have to sit there till they loaded all those stretchers on that track vehicle. It's called an alligator. And it was a little uncomfortable being first aboard because you had to wait for the other dozen to
get aboard.
How long do you think you were waiting?
I don't know. It seemed like forever.
Because the enemy was still firing.
Shells could come in any time. Mortar shells, artillery shells there.
So it was pretty big relief when they finally got you out of there then?
Well, I think I slept most of the way because I'd had a shot of morphine. And next morning I woke up and I was in a hospital by an airport there. And the guy that sewed my ear up was a German national, and I was his 4,000th patient, he told me himself. All he did was sew my ear. It had a hole in it where the bullet went through, and he just sewed the outside down on the inside.
It didn't do any damage to your hearing on that side?
No, I say thank God the guy jerked the trigger, or I wouldn't have been here. You got to squeeze him off. I learned that as becoming a sharpshooter.
Your daughter says that when you see another Marine and you can tell he's a Marine, you have a special greeting for him.
Semper Fi.
What does that mean to you? Why is that important for you to share that bond?
The Marines are the only ones that use that term.
It's for Semper Fidelis, always faithful. What does that mean to you? Is that a part of who you are?
Well, that's what Marines do.
You mentioned the time when you got hit and the guy who saved your life, as you put it. Do you ever wonder what his name was or think about trying to find him?
Even figure out what he was doing there. He didn't have a gun. He had Army clothes on or Marine clothes. I don't know what. I didn't look at him too close. But he was a nice guy. And after I got hit with that round, why, he was right on top of me cutting my jacket off so they could get the bandage on. It was wild and woolly times.
Have you ever looked at photographs of some of those scenes from the war, or even the cemeteries left behind on some of those Pacific islands, or even the memorials we have today, and ever said, you know, that could have been me?
No, it wasn't.
You know, there's a famous quote about the Marines in the Pacific, and in fact, it's inscribed on the side of the Marine Corps Memorial, where they have the giant, larger-than-life statue of the flag raising atop Mount Suribachi, and it's from Admiral Nimitz, and it says, "Uncommon valor was a common virtue." Did that sound about right to you?
That's about the way the Marines are doing.
Well, I know one thing you're familiar with because you were sharing it. There were 8 medals of honor awarded to veterans of the Battle of Peleliu, and one of them was one that sounded like it left a particular impression on you. You want to tell me about that?
Well, the guy blew up with satchel charges, took 16 satchel charges to do what he did. He threw a satchel charge in each emplacement and blew out of the emplacement or killed him. Satchel charge is a pretty potent thing. It's a knapsack which has composition C in it, I guess, and a timer. You got so long to get rid of it, and then it's going to go off.
In fact, it sounded like it was something you didn't want to mess with yourself.
Well, I wasn't familiar with it, and bad enough being in combat, but you don't want to be fooling around with something you don't understand.
In that battle, one of the things that strikes me from the accounts I've read and the veterans I've talked to who were there is not knowing where the enemy was a lot of time. It seems like you're always on edge. How did you deal with that uncertainty? And it seems like you're constantly wondering where they are and what's going to happen next.
Well, we didn't worry about it too much. We did what we had to do. And like I was telling you about getting behind that tank with the 4 guys. And I was a squad leader. I think there were 3 or 4 groups of 12 in the platoon.
Do you feel responsible for those guys that you were leading?
Well, I didn't want to see any of them get hurt, and they could have very easily gotten hurt because when you're firing a weapon, you always got to be conscious of where the Marines are so that you don't accidentally shoot one of them because they frown on being shot at.
Yeah, that's quite the understatement, isn't it? A Marine with a Purple Heart and a sense of humor. Mr. Wilcox, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing your story. You can find photos and more information on our guests today at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks to our sponsor, EECU. They'll both receive CD copies of the program. You can also find more information online at hometownheroesradio.com about the Honor Flight Network. San Luis Obispo is the departure airport for one of the newest Honor Flight hubs, taking World War II veterans to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. They have a flight scheduled for September 30th, another one October 21st. You can check them out online at honorflightccc.org. We're out of time. I hope you had a wonderful 4th of July. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping that on Independence Day and all year long, these stories from our veterans will help you remember that freedom is not free.